Europe had very little knowledge of it, except in those areas where the ancient Roman remains still existed. But in a comparatively short time, based upon the old Roman pattern, the city of New York became capable of becoming a great world metropolis. It was back to these old ideas, reformed, reconstructed, and redirected. The same is true in almost every field in which progress was made. In some cases, more ingenuity was presently applied than in others. But in each case, there was some inspiration derived from the common experience of man, the experience of tradition, legendary, and history. In this situation, we also see education moving into a new pattern. Education began to attract more and more people. While the communities were scattered, and while man was almost completely the servant of nature in these respects, education was restricted to a comparatively small group. The average farm boy of 125 years ago had to have his education according to the seasons of the year. The only time he could go to school was in winter, when it was very difficult to get there. In almost all other seasons, he was an essential part of economy. He had to be present for the harvesting, he had to be present for the sowing, he had to be present for all of the various duties which had to do with survival. And if he was able to secure 2 or 3 years of education, it was at great sacrifice to his family, as because of his need in the economy of his time. I know one case of a man who passed on only a few years ago, who in order to reach the school where he went to school, had to swim through 3 rivers every day. And in the early spring and late fall, when these rivers were partly frozen, it was no easy task. In fact, he looked forward hopefully to those months of winter when there were 3 and 4 feet of snow on the ground, because those were the only seasons when he didn't have to swim the rivers. This type of thing was scarcely conducive to the rapid expansion of higher education. And with the exception of a small group of metropolitan areas, the situation was rather consistent. Schooling itself in those days was also very sketchy. It was difficult, really, to find out what to teach the individual. It wasn't until about the year 1900 that people began to decide what they could be taught. Up to that time, truly, we had the 3 R's. The child was taught to read and to write and to add up simple sums. He needed all these in order to survive economically. Certainly, even though he was producing on a farm, he had to know the weights of the things he bought and sold. He had to be able to keep some record of transactions, although in many cases, grown people kept the records only by making nicks in the side of trees. In these days, education as a planned program for man's social adjustment with progress was comparatively unknown. His education was largely in order to him that he might live, that he might exist, that he might keep some records of his daily transactions, that he might communicate with his loved ones, should they be at a distance or he be traveling, or that he could read his Bible. These were the concerns which prompted his achievements. It was not until a little later that education was really formalized. As late as 1850 and 1860, lawyers, doctors, and other professional persons were simply studied by an apprenticeship method, and perhaps had a very brief interlude of formal training. All these situations began to reflect upon the life of the people, an expanding economy, a gradually improving level of living demanded greater intellectual achievement, demanded greater perspective, and greater skill to keep up with the changes that were taking place. So we can say that by 1850, there were marked improvements, and the modern theory of education was coming into existence. This theory of education has constantly expanded since that time. But education also is a form of liberation. Perhaps, as we have previously suggested, one of the greatest of all, the liberalizing factors, was our increasing orientation in the field of the sciences, for the reason that through greater knowledge of biology, chemistry, physics, also the scientific arts, such as anthropology and things of that nature, we were beginning to sense our relationship not only to a larger universe, but to a universe of potentials. We were beginning to realize that around us were great untapped sources of raw material. We began to consider the possibility of chemistry on an industrial level. And we were thinking more and more of illumination, even prior to the development of the electric light, the coming of the telephone, and things of that nature. All of these were motions toward liberation. But most of all, they liberated the mind into a kind of mood of expectancy. So one thing we can say of the first half of the 19th century was that it was composed of those years in which human expectancies grew great. Perhaps again, in contrast to the first half of the present century, in which our expectancies have gradually diminished. Until now, the average person faces the future with great fear. The 19th century man, on the level of education, faced the 19th century with a great hope. He began to see the roots and beginnings of things, many of which had great promise. He was not yet disillusioned by the fact that everything he devised could be abused. He was still in the devising stage, and he saw many wonderful possibilities, dreams, and adventures, as expressed in the writings of Jules Verne and other men of the time, who really expressed the fantasy of the 19th century mind. It was a world in which everyone was busy accomplishing something. Each one saw an opportunity to improve himself in some way, perhaps only in his comforts and commodities, but certainly he was working for objectives. Now, labor, at this time also, began to come into conflict with education. Labor, at that time, and we can go back to our statistics because I checked some of these in official records. A laboring man around the turn of the century, around the year 1800 to 1810, usually went to work at 5 o'clock in the morning and ended what he called an ordinary day at 7 o'clock at night. Therefore, a fair working day was about 14 hours. During these 14 hours also, he was not allowed very much leisure. There were not many coffee breaks in those days. Usually, his work was being watched carefully, not by a foreman, but by a prudent farmer or someone of that nature who had learned from his cattle and his horses that in order to get the best results, you drove them hard. At that time, there was not too much consideration for what it might mean to the individual to have a little rest or a few privileges. At last, there was a tremendous revolution that threatened to rock the foundations of American economy. And by means of this revolution, the working day was shortened to the hideously restricted period of 12 hours. No one believed that the nation would survive the shock. One man got up and said, in that length of time, nothing worthwhile can be done. The struggle also to determine whether the other 2 hours should be paid for that were no longer being used took 50 years to settle. But with that kind of work, and it was a 6-day week, the individual had only one day of the week left. He had very little method of illumination in his home. Therefore, with a few exceptions, he did no evening reading or anything of that kind. He was too tired, and his way of life did not provide adequate facilities or inducements. Even with a 12-hour day, he was rather busy, because in that same period, the seventh day was also a rather arduous day. a good family in good Orthodox standing started its religious observances on Sunday morning by early prayer at anywhere from 5:30 to 6 a.m. From about 8 o'clock in the morning to 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon was devoted entirely to religious services. And the really devout went back and had a further treatment in the evening. In order to get to your place of worship, you might have to drive 2 or 3 hours in a dashboard buggy. So Sunday was not exactly a day all to yourself. Somewhere in this pattern also, the devout woman, who of course had to go to church and fulfill all the services, and on this day was expected to bring the hired people in also, the maids, or the gardeners, or the hired men, whatever it might be, they all had the right to go to church and to put on their best suits and to fix up their boots with goose grease and be at their very best. After this was all over, sometime during the day, the good woman of the house might be expected to prepare a Sunday dinner for anywhere from 12 to 40 people. So it was not what might be termed a quiet Sabbath. Under these conditions, it was evident that the intellectual life of the people was not inclined to flourish. It was necessary to begin to restrict hours of labor in order to release men for the privileges of study. Around 1810, one of the first of these moves was made in an attack upon the employment of small children in labor. In other words, a move was taken, particularly in the urban areas, the towns and communities, to make it required that children would have some opportunity for schooling. Originally, the minimum guarantee was 2 years. Gradually, this was increased, and there was a greater psychological emphasis against using child labor. But it was not until past the middle of the century that these reforms really took on complete proportions. But it was at this time that it began to be fashionable for children to have a chance to go to school. Of course, this fashion was not able to reach the suburban areas for some time later, because on the farm the child was valued merely as a contribution to the general survival. Thus we had a beginning of a fight for education, which meant at that time that only a minute fraction of our population could hope to have what we would term a college education. But the battle of the mind over the economic necessity continued. And about before the year of 1850, we begin to see another trend showing up in employment, and that is the beginning of selectivity in favor of the educated person. And this, of course, immediately changed the whole picture. As soon as education meant income, means to attain it took on a great deal more character. The first half of the century was also devoted to a measure in the experiment of wealth. And this experiment, wealth now, assumed as a means of liberation. This experiment was undertaken with more naivete than we can hardly appreciate. It was almost completely sugar-coated in idealistic indoctrination. Wealth was always regarded at that time as the indication of superior virtue. The wealthy individual was the one who worked hard, long hours, and kept all of the formulas of an Horatio Alger hero. By luck and pluck, by vim and vigor, he rose above mediocrity. There was never a suggestion in any of this collection of penny wonderfuls that there were any conspiracies possible in finance. Always merit won, always demerit was punished, so that we ended upon or trusted our weight to the rather uncertain ground of high finance with a tremendous amount of optimistic integrity. We were quite convinced that wealth in the new way of things, under our modern way of life, was going to be the reward for virtue, and that only the virtuous could possibly become rich. I might add that there's been some disillusionment in this direction since. we are not quite as secure in our feelings on the matter. But as we do all things in the same way, we attack wealth with the firm belief that it was going to prove to be the greatest emancipating force. Wealth was going to enable us to buy intelligence. It was going to enable us to spend money for self-improvement. When this wealth began to accumulate, we didn't always use it that way, but that was the idea. So in the first half of the 19th century, liberation from mediocrity through the possibility of private wealth and private industry began to take powerful force. It was then that we began our pattern of rugged individualism that ended in 1929 in ragged individualism. It was a long and disillusioning period in which we struggled to prove that by means of wealth we could be happy, we could be secure, and we could attain peace. During that period, anything that seemed to endanger this situation, particularly from the outside, was simply rejected, cast aside, and considered no part of a world which was completely surrounded by the invisible wall of the Monroe Doctrine. This situation goes on into other brackets, and I think that out of the various ones, we're going to have to pause somewhere. We can't cover them all, because we have some other things to do, but we will mention only that the rising of economics, the rising tide of transportation and communication opening the world, industrial and trade alliances with other nations, and the development of science, particularly first in England and Germany and later in the United States, meant that the 19th century separated itself from all preceding time. And we began to see the emerging of the organized human society that we recognize today, a society heavily dependent upon the provisions of science, a society made as secure as it is by the tremendous advancement which we have made, particularly in scientific industrialism. Now, in this period, of course, we had this conviction that everything that we were doing was being done for the good of man. Man was taking under humanism, which had been developing in the 18th century, a very large place in the pattern. The 18th century humanists, like Rousseau or Montesquieu or even Voltaire, had stated clearly that man is king of his world, that in this material world, man can do anything that he can do, that there is no limitation upon him except the limitation which he places upon himself, that anything that he can capture in nature, he has a right to. And this gradually developed into a rather rugged attitude that nature existed only to be exploited by man. Natural resources, everything, were available for man to use as he pleased. And scientific progress was teaching him how to use these things according to a code which was becoming intensively materialistic. As the proprietor of the universe, man gained a swelled head. He began to regard himself as a being with limitless opportunity and no responsibility. In his scientific researches, he had not been enough of a historian to realize that other people, in other ways, had tried this before him and had come to grief. He did not recognize the moral and ethical responsibilities of increasing temporal ability and authority. This tragedy was pointed out over 100 years ago, but men were too busy succeeding at that time to pay much attention to it. They could not conceive that their own individual rights should be subjected voluntarily to a pattern of ethics. So the 19th century, from the beginning of end to end, shows a rising tide of rights and a slowly lowering level of ethics. This meant that by the end of the 19th century, liberated man had fallen almost completely into the slough of materialism. He had achieved a vast amount of skill. He was gradually solving the problems of sanitation and of housing and of ventilation. He was beginning to attack very boldly the matter of income and private wealth and private ownership. And yet with all these things, he was not achieving his primary end, security. This security was still eluding him. He was liberated from everything except his own ignorance. He had a new kind of knowledge, but this knowledge was not a panacea for a grand ignorance. Thus, as his intelligence became more and more specialized, and the area of it was increasingly restricted by his interests, he began to lose sight completely of his true relationship to the universe of which he was a part. The universe became less important to him. Ancient man stood in awe of everything. Modern man stood in awe only of his own achievements. Ancient man feared the universe. Modern man, as a result of 25 or 30 centuries of evolution, came to that more exalted condition in which he feared himself and other human beings. The dinosaur was gone, but man was still afraid because he was gradually losing confidence in man. Liberation was liberating characteristics and qualities within human nature which religion had frustrated and which circumstances had denied. The loosening of religion and the broadening of circumstances therefore caused man to exhibit out of himself tendencies which had been long frustrated and which became more violent because of this frustration. It was therefore well before the end of the century that those who were really thoughtful began to see the handwriting on the wall. They began to recognize that we had to have a new definition for liberty, a new definition for the right of the individual in relation to the common good of all men. History records this procedure with great accuracy and brings us down to the second century of this era with a great many facts available. Now, history, unfortunately, like all other forms of learning, is useful only to those who will examine it. And as our own thinking changes, we must realize that histories are written under the pressures of prevailing concepts. Little by little, therefore, the historical works of our generation have lost their moral integration. History now is regarded as a statement of bare facts. History is limited largely today to the competitive recounting of the scientific achievements of the last century. History as a record of the basic state of man is almost totally ignored. History as a record of mistakes is conveniently forgotten. Yet the histories do exist, and they are available to the individual who is willing to question the success of that which is obviously very shaky. If, however, we depend upon popular historians and depend upon histories which have been watered down for the consumption of our young people, we shall realize that the great issues of history are carefully avoided. These issues include man's 20th century relationship to the consequences of his 19th century conduct. Also, the record of man continuing persistently to perpetuate mistakes. Individual, because of his hyper-individualistic attitude today, has followed in an ancient false formula. He has assumed that because he is an individual, he is an exception to the rules governing all other individuals. History points out that it cannot find one of these exceptions. But man is not interested in that phase. When he studies the lives of great dictators, he conveniently glosses over their ultimate disasters. He reads that part of history which seems to support him, and ignores that which demonstrates that he is wrong. Thus, 20th century history is very largely today a record of 19th century and early 20th century achievement. It reads like a fairy tale. It is just more wonderful than words can find, and certainly should cause every young person to be blissfully ignorant of the truth. Namely, that many of these historical episodes or historical circumstances have been utterly interpreted away from the fact. The truth of the matter as it is today is that all history, from ancient times and far places down to the present time, has demonstrated clearly that no civilization can survive the decadence of its culture. That civilizations are not overthrown by their enemies on the outside, but by the decline of their own ethical standard on the inside. That we are not captured by barbarians, but are enslaved by the perpetual barbarian within ourselves. Thus, all history tells us that unless we pause and take some advantage of the lesson of history, that we are headed for trouble. Now, in this emergency, many things could theoretically be done. History could become a valuable key to assisting us in restoring a balance of values. No one wants us to go back to a 14-hour day, nor a 12-pound-a-year salary. No one expects us to give up all the conveniences and commodities with which we have become accustomed. But history does warn us that moderation alone contributes to survival and that all excess destroys. This is as factual as though it was demonstrated in a laboratory. And it has been demonstrated in some levels in a laboratory. The inevitable conclusion must be that a people under a fanaticism or under a pressure, an ideological dynamic, will have a tendency to ignore the greater part of its own cultural need to the overdevelopment of a particular. Unbalance has always been the cause of historical decline as we have it from the beginning of time. Compromise is another. From the time that the Romans attempted to compromise with the Huns, we have never had an example of a successful compromise in history, especially on a level of nations. We have also learned that wherever in history the economic, political power of a people surpasses in its growth, in its rate of growth, the cultural, ethical, moral growth of a people, that people will inevitably pervert knowledge. Therefore, that an individual who knows more than his conduct can sustain in a manner of integrity is a menace. We are full into this problem. Now we have finally accomplished liberation from ignorance, so that today ignorance, in the classical meaning of the term, is comparatively extinct in our way of life and is rapidly disappearing in the outlying areas around our culture. On the other hand, we have not achieved a liberation from knowledge, and that seems to be our next challenge. First, we were enslaved by what we did not know. And we have at least 3,500 years of history to prove that. Now we are becoming enslaved by what we do know. So that instead of the man being the master, now knowledge is the master. And knowledge is moving man to the fulfillment of its own blind purposes. Man has given up serving other men, but he is now serving the thoughts of specialists. As a result of this kind of slavery, the individual as an individual is rapidly disappearing. And in his place, dominion is in the hands of policy. It is assumed that man must act according to the progress of his sciences, must adjust himself to the motions of his industries, and must accept whatever directive his economy imposes upon him. In other words, his achievements have become too big for him. And in the presence of this utter inconsistency, we must also come to the realization that science, industry, and economics are not beings. They are not rational creatures. They are not moral structures. They are simply techniques. They are methods. They are means for accomplishing certain purposes. And within the structure of each means is only the directive to its own ends. Therefore, anything lying beyond the original ends will not be considered by the means by which those ends are attained. In this way, we have placed ourselves under the complete dominion of an amoral force, a force which could not teach us anything on an ethical level, because it is not a rational creature capable of devising an ethical code. Now, we like to assume that instead of ethics, we are now substituting policy based upon inevitable processes of universal law. We like to assume that science is revealing to us a lawful universe. We like to assume also that through trial and error and experimentation, we have gradually come into adjustment with the peculiar laws governing economics and industry. We have very little to prove that we have accomplished this, because nearly every day we are under the severe pressure of reverses which should not occur in a lawful structure. In substance, then, the ancient man was in slavery to a class of aristocrats. Modern man is in slavery to a group of ideas. These ideas are not bad, any more than an automobile is bad. But an automobile is a deadly weapon in the hands of a psychologically imbalanced person. It is also a deadly weapon in the hands of an ethically immature person. There is nothing wrong with the automobile. The trouble lies in the lack of responsibility and integrity, understanding, or skill of the driver, or in the case of the so-called unavoidable accident, perhaps of the construction of the vehicle itself. Actually, however, in our modern way of life, we need history. History comes to us in the form of a kind of religion. History tells us, beyond any doubt, that the essential theme of the ancient fairy tale is more true than the products of the modern laboratory. For it was the essence of the ancient fable that good must triumph. It was the essence of the ancient legend that with many adversities and reverses and great hazards and dangers, the hero must be true to his principles and must finally demonstrate his own integrity, thus establishing himself as a true hero, as a superior person entitled to live happily ever after. Our present policy is not assuring us of any of these things. Thus we come into the second century of our great cycle, beginning in the year 1900, inheriting a series of mistakes which have never been corrected, and inheriting also a new vista of time. Because one thing that we haven't pointed out as yet in relation to the philosophy of history is that history is related to time. And time, in its largest dimension, as far as our moral life is concerned, is opportunity. Time for us today is future. Time is an allotment between the sowing and reaping, during which it is our privilege and duty to act properly in the gardening of our crop. If we do not use the interval between cause and effect with a certain moral definition, the effect is going to be correspondingly deformed. Thus, time is available to us to make history. Out of the consideration of the past, man could evolve a complete historical theology. History can convince him, on the level of fact, of practically every element of ancient religion. History can prove to him the Ten Commandments of the Mosaic Code with greater certainty than any moralist can define them. History can prove conclusively the integrity of the Sermon on the Mount. Yet at the same time, at any moment in history, men may violently deny these ethical principles and presumably demonstrate they can survive without them. But history, again, is a measure of survival. History is not something which merely extends around the immediate moment. History is that condition or that motion in time by which all things finally leave their immediate significance to gradually increase in perspective until they become world values. Thus, I think we should take into consideration that this era of liberation, which must go on for the best part of 450 years into the future, represents, as we see it today, certainly at this period in its development, the desperate need to untangle the heritage which we received. We have become like a group of children who have inherited a parental estate and are now squabbling over it. We do not want to be like those children who also squander the estate. For we know today that in the majority of cases, children will squander their inheritances. To squander the inheritance of history is to bankrupt a civilization. It is to destroy its relationship to the laws which govern the socialized motion of species and groups. Thus, in the future, man must continually liberate himself. And we can turn to some of the philosophical episodes marked in history to determine how this can be done. And wherever it has successfully been assailed, and has achieved at least a temporary victory, this has always resulted from the individual gradually gaining a moderate attitude toward the situations in which he finds himself. The motion away from extreme. Now let us take an example of an extreme as we know it today. We are concerned constantly over the increased cost of living. We are threatened that in many fields of activity it will probably rise 1% a month for some time yet. It is quite possible that this rise will be blocked by the early introduction of effects from some of the immediately preceding causes, and this may be blocked to some degree, but we are concerned very seriously with it at the moment. Yet on every hand we find that the individual declines to moderate his own demands upon life. He is constantly seeking more with which to meet the rising costs of life. This can go on to a most exaggerated state, or it can result in the complete collapse of what might otherwise be a very useful economic theory. It rests again with the individual, or with the group of individuals, who must regain control over the policies which they themselves have established. These policies cannot be permitted to run headlong or to act like a horse that had used, that once escaped and ran away. These commodities, these policies, these processes, these patterns must finally be moderated. They must be brought within the pattern of the reasonable, or they cannot survive. And in our busy day, with our tremendous emphasis upon achievement, we have forgotten the science of reason. And being deprived of the science of reason, we do not know how to be reasonable. I talked to a man about it not long ago, and he said, "Well, that's all right. I guess you're supposed to be reasonable. Perhaps it would help." But he said, "I've got a private philosophy of my own, which seems to be working for me. And that is, instead of being reasonable, take all you can get while you can get it." The same man is wailing on the fact that he can't keep anything that he's getting. So the situation is not as optimistic as even he would like to assume. Contemplation upon history produces the philosopher historian. It makes the individual realize that from history can be derived the working solution to practically any problem that we face today. We say to each other, sometimes to ourselves, we do not know the answer. Yet there is no principle with which we are concerned today which has not previously been applied in some way. And the operations of that principle can be studied and estimated with almost infallible accuracy. What we hope is that these principles will not be consistent. We hope that we can prove ourselves an exception to the rule of life. This is going to be a little difficult, and we are more optimistic than stable in our attitude. Actually, from the philosophy of history, we can find the working formulas for things that we want today. We know how crime can be solved. We know how juvenile delinquency can be solved. We know how religious intolerance and racial intolerance can be solved. We also know how the danger of depression can be removed. We know how peace can be achieved. We know how the individual's personal security can be advanced. We know how health can be improved. We know how old age can be retarded. We know all of these things. But we do not wish to face the implications of them. So we prefer to drift, hoping for the best, and with a very profound internal conviction that the best is not going to occur. As a proof, more or less, of this uncertainty, we can note the tremendous revival of religious interest in the United States and in other countries. Men are becoming a little frightened, and in their fear, they are on the verge of restoring a few phases of the divine initiative. When man can't run the universe, he gives it back to God. While he can run it, he denies God any part in it. Actually, there are not these unsolvable mysteries. There are simply patterns that are factual. Patterns, however, which cannot be applied unless there are major changes in our policies of living. The individual cannot remain the same and get better. In order to achieve practically every end that we conceive to be valuable, we must liberate ourselves from the fixation of our present infallibility. We have got to face a number of facts, and we've got to dignify reason. Restore the rational power of man. We have got to recognize that the greatest asset that humanity possesses is the creative rationality of the enlightened human being. Without this asset, all else fails. and all systems which so regiment men that this creative contribution is denied, frustrated, or lost will pay for this regimentation with their own existence. These facts we know simply from history. Therefore, we cannot say that it is a dull, dry subject, nor can we say that it has no place in religion or no place in philosophy, that it belongs to the moldy systems of ancient culture. It does not. It is a constant living value. It is a mirror into which we constantly must look to see the reflection of our own way of doing things. History of the 20th century is a shocking example of the results of an excessive 19th century departure from ethics. Without what happened in the 19th century, the 20th century would not have followed. And if the 20th century does not solve some of these problems, it will again sow a whirlwind and reap a whirlwind. If then, in history, we have the result of collective action, let us also realize that the historical entity, considered as a total, is also a kind of abstract personality. That which the total historical entity has found to be unreasonable will never be reasonable in the conduct of an individual. That which has failed for a thousand different dictators will never succeed for another dictator. But he is always hoping that it will. That which maybe a billion or 2 billion human beings have found to be untrue, we will not prove to be true. I do not mean in opinion. I mean in practice. I mean in the experience of how to live and what the consequences will be. Man has struggled through a great many levels of primitive life, but he has achieved and survived because of certain values, and his survival has never flowered into its proper maturity because of the absence of certain other values. As long as values remain as they are, some present and other important ones absent, our civilizations will continue to be inconclusive. We will never achieve the final consummation that we desire. Out of this fact also comes a recognition that a human family is not different from a family of nations, that the beliefs of whole generations of persons have produced effects very similar to those effects that will occur to us if we as persons hold the same beliefs. Thus, history is forever a generalization upon a particular. And history is always capable of bestowing this generalization upon a particular, assisting that particular, a person, in his own orientation. If, therefore, we go back over these periods, we will find that the intolerances and intemperances of history are merely mass examples of the intolerances and intemperances of individuals. What happened to the nation or the race because of a certain intemperance or intolerance will inevitably occur to an individual who follows the same procedure. Thus, history becomes a personal guide as well as a collective guide. Recognizing, as the tradition of the Phoenix tells us, that this is the great era of liberation, man's duty is to liberate himself from anything and everything that prevents him from being a balanced, mature human being. He must liberate himself from childishness, from his own adolescence. He must liberate himself from false, glamorous hopes. He must liberate himself from inanity, stupidity, and a kind of learned ignorance in which he knows much, but nothing that he knows helps him to live better. He must liberate himself from the great collective policies which now tell him that this and that are acceptable, fashionable, and necessary. He must do these things to what degree he can, in his personal life, and to the degree he succeeds, he improves his personal life. He must also face the fact that by collective action, he must ultimately achieve these things collectively in order that nations may have security and freedom from the national diseases of poverty, war, and unemployment. These problems are all scientifically understandable and demonstrable. And the purpose of science is to discover the whole truth. And that whole truth is that the world of knowledge is suspended from a world of good laws. And that the universe of scientific achievement is meaningless unless it is governed by ethical attainment. These patterns may astonish us, may disturb us, may worry us, but we must ultimately face them historically, namely that these things must be done, and until they are done, there will be no change in our patterns of security and insecurity. Consequently, a philosophy of history, which makes the whole subject worthwhile, brings us into kinship with the ancient world, shows us how we are really reaching our hands across time to clasp the hands of heroes who have shown us good ways before, that our understanding is, in a sense, completely beyond chronological limitation. In the urgent need of mankind, it is not nearness or remoteness of time, but essential value of quality that is important. In order to win our final fight, we must learn from all that knew more than we do, and we must teach all that know less. And until these ends are attained, history will be a record of trial and error, of some success and many failures. But we can improve it, and we can gain from it, and we can grow through the contemplation of it into a better way of life for ourselves. And now our time is up, so next week we will begin a new series of studies in which we are going to take